Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Saying something sucks is not a take. It's lazy. Low-hanging fruit. You have to do better. When I say, have a take, don't suck, what I mean is, saying something sucks is not a take. Now that I've said that yet again, let me say this. Last night's game, the national championship game, it sucked. It just did. Like, if you were looking for a competitive game in the college football playoff, you didn't get it. No, instead, you got jammed yet again. Bama, 52. Ohio State, 24. Everybody showed up expecting a track meet. Instead, a boat race broke out. Let's get one thing out of the way. Early on, I know Ohio State was missing a number of players. However, they could have had those guys on the field last night. They still weren't winning. They could have had everybody and perfect health and played their best game. Their best was not beating Alabama's best, because that's just how good Alabama was last night. That's how good Alabama has been the entire season. I mean, for years now, college football has been Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, and then everybody else. This year, though, it was Alabama and then everybody else. No matter who you were or what your team did, if you thought you had any chance against this Alabama team, you're begging. Texas A&M, you got stomped 52-24. Georgia, have a 17-point loss. Auburn, take a seat, fire your coach. Florida, nice try. Like, remember when everybody watched Alabama beat Notre Dame by 17 and then rushed in and hammered Notre Dame, questioned whether or not Notre Dame belonged in the playoff? I mean, suddenly, losing by 17 looks like a major accomplishment when Ohio State got blasted by 28. This Alabama team was so dominant that Notre Dame held them to 31, and that was the lowest output all season long. And that game was never close. I mean, at this point, it's absurd. It's just stupid. And so was last night. Completely stupid and totally and utterly absurd. It's an Ohio State team. Totally trashed. Totally absurd. Totally stupid. Now, I mean, again, this is an Ohio State team that smashed Clemson a week and a half ago. And yet last night, they spent the entire game grasping at air and trying to make that game respectable. About the only thing normal in a completely surreal world these days is Bama winning another national title. And this one looked easier than most. I mean, there was nothing the Buckeyes could do to stop that Alabama offense. Mac Jones did whatever the hell he wanted. Najee Harris did what he wanted. Devontae Smith did what he wanted. There was that Harris touchdown that was a genius play design carried out by amazing players.
Here now, Alabama on a second down play. Mac looks wide open, left side. Najee out of the backfield, makes the grab at the 10, cuts inside the defense. He'll fire forward. He's got a touchdown. They lost him out of the backfield, 26 yards.
Then there was that Smith touchdown that ended the game. Ended the game in the first half.
Mac straight drop. Mac looks long. Mac finds Devontae behind the defense. He is in for a touchdown. Thank you, Mr. Heisman. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien, and Unitas Award winner. What a combination. 44 yards. Touchdown, Alabama.
Learfield, IMG Radio. Hey, listen, I could go on, but really I can't. Because I can't play all the Alabama touchdowns in this segment. I would just run out of time. And again, this was against a good Ohio State team. Last night's not a reflection on Ohio State. Just like that semifinal was not a reflection on Notre Dame. Just like the SEC championship game was not a reflection on Florida or any of the games this season. They weren't about anything other than Alabama. It didn't matter who was on the field. They were, to quote Juju Smith-Schuster, nameless gray faces compared to Alabama. And of course, a game like that was going to inspire the ultimate bargument. Is this the best team in college football history? And normally that's like the dumbest argument in college football history. Because normally when people ask that question, the answer is no. Mac Jones. Now, Mac Jones has his own opinion. Mac Jones thinks that this is, in fact, the best team ever.
I think we're the best team to ever play. I mean, there's no team that will ever play SEC schedule like that again.
You know, fair enough. Sort of, kind of. Like, we can debate just how good the SEC was this year, but you cannot debate the fact that this team went undefeated in a pandemic and almost none of the games were close. So, is this the greatest college football team ever? I've got no idea. And neither do you, and neither does anybody else. I mean, could this Alabama team beat the Tommy Frazier Nebraska teams? Who knows? And I'm not going to get into some sort of breakdown of how Nick Saban would scheme it up against Newt Rockne. I'm not even going to try and talk about how the 2020 Alabama club would do against Reggie Bush and Matt Leinart on those great USC teams. I'm not going to waste time on that. However, I've got no problem saying this. This is something we can't say with certainty. This is not some made-for-TV, contrived bullcrap to get reaction. I'll say this. Nick Saban is the greatest coach in college football history. 7 national titles, 6 in his 14 years at Alabama. This was supposed to be the era of parity in college football. The proliferation of college football on television was supposed to level the playing field and mean that more programs had more shots at being elite. And yet the Nicktator has absolutely obliterated the idea and smashed it into 1,000 pieces. In fact, he doesn't just have 6 titles in 14 years at Bama. He's got 6 in the last 12 years. So it's a coin flip every year. Heads, Alabama wins a title. Tails, they come this close to winning a title. So that kind of dominance does not happen. At least, it's not supposed to happen. Not in college football, not with teenagers playing, and not with guys going to the league every single year. And yet this guy, this joyless wonder, is doing it year in and year out and pretending like he's absolutely miserable while he's doing it. So while I'm not going to waste any time debating whether or not we just saw the greatest team in college football history, I can say this. Not only is he the greatest coach ever, I'm going to say that that's his best team ever. I'll say that. And if you're Nick Saban and that's your best team ever, then you've got a pretty good argument that maybe you are the greatest college football team ever. And that definitely is his best team ever. It is. I'm not even sure it's close. He's got 6 rings at Alabama, 1 at LSU, and it says here this Alabama team beats every one of the other 6 national champions he's coached. Even Nick himself would tell you that.
Well, you know, to me, this team accomplished more almost than any team. No disrespect to any other teams that we had or any championship teams, but this team won 11 SEC games. No other team has done that. They won the SEC and went undefeated in the SEC. And then they beat 2 great teams in the playoffs with no break in between.
I mean, normally you ask him a question like that, and that's a reason to go. But instead, he couldn't wait to tell you that. I mean, sure, the defense is not the best defense he's had, but that offense is. It's not even close. And the crazy thing about this team is they did all of this during a pandemic. I mean, that's crazy. But even crazier than that is they weren't supposed to be this good. Remember last year, Joe Burrow and LSU destroyed college football. They set the gold standard for offensive football. And yet months later, Alabama was nearly a replica of them. Instead of having 1 Heisman candidate, the Tide had 3 inside the top 5. They had 3. And they did it with a quarterback who was not supposed to be the guy. And a wide receiver who was not supposed to be the guy either. Again, nobody was thinking that Mac Jones was going to lead the most electric offense in Alabama history when he showed up in Tuscaloosa. Everybody thought the Tide offense was going to stagnate too when Jalen Waddle was injured. But thanks to Devontae Smith, they actually got better. Smith was so good last night, he's going to get his own take today. But suffice it to say, that is one of the freakiest, scariest dudes I have ever seen on the field. And if everything went to plan this year, he would have been the number 2 wide receiver in that offense. So Alabama winning a national title is the most predictable thing ever. Remember, it is a coin flip every year now for more than a decade. except Alabama winning this national title the way they did in a pandemic was one of the most unpredictable things ever. The dynasty was supposed to be over, and yet it's still here and stronger than ever. And a big hat tip to the Nicktator. No one's better and no one's more miserable. The only thing that would have made that game interesting is if Nick Saban's daughter opened a new Twitter account and live tweeted some of her crazy talk during that game. Clones, what do we want when we're craving protein or we need more energy? Not bars, not sugary snacks, not energy drinks. Man, we want beef, pure and simple. So where is the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is not your old man's jerky. Shriveled, dry, tasteless. Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices. They're smoked over a real wood fire, so it's tender and it's tasty. It's not rough. And why is it so good? It's because of the folks involved. Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for their relentless commitment to quality. They take smoked beef extremely seriously. I've spoken with and know members of the family. They are legit. They're the real deal. Old Trapper is packed with protein, and it comes in four amazing flavors. So look for it in major retail stores near you. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Sheldrick Redwine is my guest. Sheldrick, good to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you for having me.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. That was great. So before we get into the win over Pittsburgh, can you take us back to the lead up to that game? You beat the Steelers in that closeout in the regular season, and then you're in the playoffs, but you know you got to go into that game without your head coach, without other members of the coaching staff. You had some key teammates who tested positive as well. So what was your reaction when you heard all that news, and what was the collective mindset going into the game?
You know, it was shocking, you know, to see a lot of that stuff happen. But, you know, the collective mindset was, you know, do anything that it takes to get the job done, you know. We know those guys are going to be with us in spirit, you know, Coach Stefanski, you know, having him out, you know, that was a big blow. But it was, Kate, don't let anything distract us from the ultimate goal of just going out there and getting the job done to get the win.
Sheldrick Redwine is joining us. So you have that mindset coming in. I would imagine it was pretty important to get off to a quick start. But then you come out and the defense scores on the very first play of the game. What was the vibe like among the players at that point after that play?
Oh, man, it was like we knew it was on. You know, after that, you know, that's as fast as a start you can ask to get out to, you know. So it really gave us the momentum, you know, and I feel like we kept that momentum, you know, for a long time, enabling us to be able to jump out to that early lead, you know. So having a play like that is great, you know, starting out like that and really getting the defense hyped up.
So you get out quickly, and the next thing you know, it's 14-0, then it's 21-0. And then on Pittsburgh's next drive, you come up with the interception. Can you take me through the play? What did you see on that play?
Oh, yeah, on that play, I think it was a former cover two, you know, and I've seen, you know, the – receiver couldn't really threaten me outside, you know, so I seen him melting inside, so I melted with him. And then our defensive line got great pressure, forcing a high throw. You know, he threw it high. It tipped off the receiver's hands, you know, and he just fell into my lap, man. It was a great feeling.
We're talking to Cleveland Browns Sheldrick Redwine. The Browns getting ready to play Kansas City. You know, so three plays later, the score, the offense makes it 28-0. You go on to win by double digits. Listen, I don't want to make this about me, but I've been riding with you guys for the last couple of years, but there were a lot of experts predicting that you guys would lose. Even Juju Smith-Schuster made his comments. In fact, how aware were you of what was being said, what he said, and then how much did that motivate the guys in the locker room?
You know, we were aware of what was said, you know, but like I said, we didn't let that distract us. You know, a lot of that stuff be for the media, you know, so we just like to keep it there, you know, and we like to really just go out and perform, you know, opposed to really getting into disputes and stuff over what's being said.
I mean, listen, like any athlete, you can only control what you can control, and you can only control yourself and your reaction to things. But I'm kind of curious. It's your second season in Cleveland. You know the history of the Browns. Even if you had nothing to do with it, and the guys you play with really had nothing to do with it, you know about that history. So how has this group gone about changing the culture and creating something new with the Browns?
Oh man, we've taken taken it to heart, you know, that we've been able to come in and change the culture, you know, that of the organization. You know, it's a great feeling to be able to be a part of a huge change of something that you know has a long history of, you know. So I'm thankful for it, and the guys are really thankful for this opportunity, and we're just trying to make the most of it.
That's the thing is, maybe you weren't a part of what came or what happened before you got there, but the fans are, and the fans, man, they've been through some tough years, lean years, rough years. What's it mean to be able to give this to the fans of that town and that team?
I mean, you know, the fans love it, man. You know, they've been through it, you know, with this team. We got the fans who've been here for a long time, you know, so being able to see them smiling, you know, and coming off the plane, seeing those guys excited for us, getting the win, you know, that's exciting for us, so. You know, it's been great to be able to see how they've been reacting to our success.
Sheldrick Redwine joining us for a few more moments. It's obviously you've got work to do still yet. Everybody knows that. You're getting ready to face Patrick Mahomes and that Kansas City offense. What is the key this week as you get ready for them?
I mean, you know, just don't try to do anything too special. You know, be who we've been. You know, just continue to just build and grow as a team. You know, get that collective, you know, that collective mindset in. Have everything in place to where everybody's doing their job. Everybody knows what needs to be done and to make sure everybody's in place.
Yeah, before I let you go, I want to ask you about something off the field. I think a lot of the fans listening watch you as a player, and they don't always know what goes on within the individual or the athlete or what goes on off the field. I mentioned that you've got a foundation, and you started the Gloria Redwine Foundation. It's named after your great-grandmother. What inspired you to start that foundation?
Just knowing her, her personality. You know, she's a loving, giving person. You know, I've seen her take in people, you know, who've been less fortunate, you know, and really be able to raise multiple people, you know. She's called mom by so many people, you know, and just seeing her, how she affects the community and people respond to her, you know. I've created the foundation, you know, to give back to the community, give back to kids, you know, and to use her name kind of as an extension of that love, you know, to just bring about a change.
Good for you. Great job. Listen, one more thing. When the pandemic kicked in and everything shut down in the offseason, you were really careful to make sure that you spent your time wisely. I know you spent some time reading books on finance and motivation. You watched a lot of videos. You were looking, quote, to find myself on a deeper level. I'm always fascinated by that. I'm curious, what types of things were you reading? What kind of videos were you watching?
Man, all type of videos. You know, Eric Thomas, Steve Harvey, those motivational type guys, you know, who really helped me to grow, not only as a, you know, as a person, but, you know, on a spiritual level, you know, when they really question you to really dig into yourself to really find out what you really are, you know. So it's been a great growth process for me, you know, reading, gaining knowledge. You know, I've recently, you know, started learning about cryptocurrency, you know, a lot of stuff. You know, I just try to stick my hand in a lot of, you know, areas just to find out a little bit about a lot, you know.
Yeah, Eric Thomas is a guy. I watch him too. I've never actually spoken to him. And I make a point, Sheldrick, of finding guys like that because I want to connect with guys like that. He's the, quote, hip-hop preacher. He's got amazing energy. He's got a great background. I'm glad you mentioned crypto. I did not know that per se. Now, I bought a Bitcoin at $9,200. Dude, that has been a roller coaster ride, right?
I'm sure.
Do you have one? Do you have any? How are you approaching crypto game?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, I'm still learning about it, you know, so I put a little bit here and there. You know, nothing too crazy, you know, because I'm still learning about it. I really want to get the ins and outs about it before I really put, you know, and make a real investment towards it.
My guy, keep me posted. Keep me posted with what you learn and what you find out because I'm with you. I'm trying to learn myself, but man, that has been some kind of crazy ride. Kind of like the Browns. The Browns going up against Kansas City on Sunday. Sheldrick Redwine, safety for the Browns, joining us. Sheldrick, great to have you on, man. Good luck this weekend.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Let's talk more about America's team, the Browns. You'd think that if you just got embarrassed on national television in prime time by a team without its head coach and by a quarterback playing behind an offensive line that he literally met in the locker room before that game, you'd think that if that happened to you and only weeks earlier you were 11-0 and teams were talking about how you might make a run at the 72 Dolphins. You think if all that happened to you, you'd stop talking mess. You think that if you came into that game Sunday night as a major favorite, a heavy favorite, a 6-point favorite or more in some cases, and you left as a double-digit loser with the face of your franchise, carrying a crazy cap number next year, crying on the bench after the game, you think if that happened to you and him, you'd zip the lip. You'd think that if you were going home after a curb stomping and the Browns were moving on after breaking in their steel toes, you'd think you'd shut the hell up. You'd think, but you'd be wrong, because the Pittsburgh Steelers will not stop talking. And it's actually pretty amazing considering what happened to them on Sunday night and how they ended the season after starting 11-0 and all that talk about whether or not they might run down the 72 Dolphins. Listen, I've had Juju Smith-Schuster's back for a long, long time. Even as recently as last month when he danced all over the Bengals logo before getting blown up in a third straight loss for Pittsburgh. Like, you want to hype yourself up and your TikTok feed by moonwalking on another squad's family crest, man, you go right ahead, knock yourself out. But understand that if you do that and you don't back it up, you have to wear it. But he did. He did. Just like he had to wear his Browns is the Browns comment for the past 36 hours and counting.
Nah, I think they're still the same Browns team I play every year. I think they're nameless, great faces. Yes, they have a couple good players on their team, but at the end of the day, like, I don't know. Like, it's the Browns is the Browns.
At the end of the day, the Browns is the Browns. So he said what you just heard 5 days ago on Thursday. Quote, I think they're nameless, gray faces. They have a couple of good players on their team, but at the end of the day, I don't know. The Browns is the Browns. Yeah, so that aged about as well as that weird, lumpy hot dog spinning and shimmering in grease on that weird roller at 7-Eleven or your favorite convenience store that Matt thinks that we all eat.
The Browns is the Browns?
That take, the Browns is the Browns, aged about as well as that dog that's been spinning for 24 hours. Like, who buys those things? Who eats those things? According to Matt, America. Anyway, the Browns led him here all about it. Baker was shouting, the Browns is the Browns, running off the field Sunday night after slapping the Steelers around. Myles Garrett used Juju's comments as a voiceover for an Instagram video that he posted. And the Browns is the Browns, that tagline, has been plastered on T-shirts by numerous apparel companies in the last day and a half. So, if you're wondering, does Juju regret saying what he said? Juju does not. This is what he told the media after the game. Quote, I don't regret what I said. I said the Browns is the Browns. They came out. They played a hell of a game. Today wasn't our night. I think I like today wasn't our night better than the Browns is the Browns.
The Browns is the Browns.
Today wasn't our night is awesome. What a great line. Today wasn't our night is one of my favorite lines. What, January wasn't our year? Didn't want any of that. In all honesty, I'm actually way more down with a dude standing by what he said, even if what he said was all sorts of dumb. Like, I'm about that kind of ownership. I'm about that kind of accountability. If you're going to run it, own it. If you're going to run it, keep it. If you're going to run it, keep it. You said it. No need to walk it back. I mean, that's so much better than some canned apology that you don't mean anyway. Juju said something. He was wrong, but he didn't walk it back. So I give him credit for that. I'm fine with that. But then you've got the guys who are saying things after it happened. I mean, like Chase Claypool. Really nice player. Really nice player. Extremely physical and near impossible matchup. This guy's going to play a long time, make a lot of plays. But he went on Instagram Live yesterday and then shared his thoughts on the Browns-Chiefs game, which is coming up this weekend.
Predictions for Chiefs-Browns games. Browns get smacked. Browns are going to get clapped next week, so it's all good.
Well, man, that is the definition of rich as hell. Again, nice player. And that even seemed kind of out of character for a guy like that to say something like that. But that is rich as hell. When somebody gets clapped and says the thing that clapped him is going to get clapped, that is the definition of rich. Like, you don't get to do that. It doesn't work like that. You can't run smack from the grave. Like, I'm never going to tell somebody they can't have an opinion. But I am going to tell somebody to keep it to themselves if they're 24 hours removed from a nationally televised hospital job at the hands of the team that you're still talking junk about. I've got no problem doing that. Even if the Browns do get rolled by the Chiefs, that doesn't validate what Chase Claypool said. All it says is the Steelers would have gotten rolled harder because they just did get rolled. Again, you can't talk smack face down on the canvas about the next opponent that your bully is about to fight, right? The difference between Juju and Claypool is that Juju ran his before the game and was asked about it after the game. Claypool is out here fresh off that ass kicking with the benefit of hindsight, and he's still talking. It's incredible. Like I said at the very top, you would think they would zip the lip, and you'd be wrong if you thought so. Claypool's comments got back to Browns D lineman Adrian Claiborne, who retweeted them and then thumbed out, quote, "Just go on vacation already, young fella." It's a great comment. Just go on vacation already, young fella. Some damn good advice, especially coming from a guy who put you on holiday. And turn off the phone. Stop talking about the Browns. Keep them out your mouth. They just destroyed you. They destroyed you, so go on vacation or go on staycation in this pandemic. I don't know. Vacation, staycation, whatever it is. It's free time. And that's one of the perks of getting tattooed on national TV and knocked out of the playoffs by your rival. There aren't very many perks, but you do have that one.
Browns are going to get clapped next week, so it's all good.
That's all good? It's all good. They just knocked you the hell out.
It's all good.
They just ended your would-be dynasty.
It's all good.
But it's all good? How is that all good? All good? How is it even partially good? How is it good at all?
It's all good.
You just got hammered by the Browns, a team you've owned forever. How is that all good?
It's all good.
What? If the Chiefs hammer them, it's all good? They hammered you. Hey, you want to hear something amazing? Check this out. Discover matches all the cash back that you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year automatically, with no limit on how much you can earn. I mean, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing because of all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of the places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. Discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report. Limitations do apply. Kelvin Sampson. Kelvin, it is so good to have you back. It's been a season unlike any other, so before we get into that, bring me up today, Kelvin. How are you? How's your family? How is life?
Jim, we're doing good. Blessed. I think this is a year of perspective. You put things, what's going on around our country, COVID, the sacrifices a lot of people are having to make just to get through an athletic season, whether it be football, basketball, whatever. You just kind of keep that in balance to the impact that COVID's had on so many lives. And I don't lose sight of that. It's a blessing to be able to coach basketball, play basketball, provide some entertainment for the fans. But we're just plowing through the season, man. How are you? How's your family?
Kevin, I appreciate you asking. We're great. My family's great. The kids are great. Janet's great. And like you, you come with a newfound perspective. In fact, I don't want to get too far off the beaten path, but like, how have you personally processed everything that's gone on and that you're seeing in this country right now? What's your process for processing all this?
I think there's a lot more conversations with your players. We had some kids that were deeply affected by what happened on May 20th with George Floyd. For a lot of people, that it's an event that takes place and you just kind of move on. But for some people, you never move on. And I have some kids on my team that were deeply, deeply affected by that because they'd gone through that in their neighborhoods and how that affected them and their families. And so we take one day a week where we just talk about issues, and that's something we've never done before. but just giving kids a platform to talk. And as a coach, I just listen. I don't have a lot of answers, but I think giving them a chance to express themselves, and that's encouraged other teammates to talk about other things, you know, what's going on politically. You know, a lot of people think that coaches and players should just shut up and play, but they're human beings too. They're no different than anybody else, and what they go through in their lives is important to me, and anything I can do to help them navigate through these times, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30 years from now, we're going to all look back and say this is a year like no other, and we're living through it right now. So, you know, it's been interesting. It's been a learning experience for all of us, but I think it's made us better because it's forced us to be listeners instead of talkers.
I appreciate those comments. Kelvin Sampson is joining us, head basketball coach at Houston. You know, Kelvin, I want to ask you about the team because you're playing really, really well right now. But when you talk about your players, the love you have for your players, how you care about them as individuals, you've said also that all of the players tested positive for COVID. As a head coach who cares about the guys individually, what was it like to hear that news? And then how did you go about supporting them throughout that entire challenge?
Well, that started back in June. In July, when our kids first came back to campus, we had so many stop and starts. But we had some kids test positive in the summer. We had some kids test positive in the fall. But we played University of South Carolina at home on December 5th. And our protocols, Jim, is we test three times a week prior to competition. Or we test 48 hours prior to competition if we have more than two games in a week. But it's... we got hit hard. We had nine kids test positive over the course of 5 days. We had to cancel or postpone, I think, four games. We already rescheduled one and played it, and we lost two of those games if we have a break in February. We'll see. But, you know, our athletic department's done a great job. My trainer here, John Houston, is a stud. He's been incredible. We did a Zoom meeting with our parents. Every kid's parent, whether it's a mom and dad or just a mom or just a dad, we're all present on the Zoom. We went through what our protocols are, how we're going to take care of their sons, what we're doing, and what our process is. But we have rooms set aside in different dorms where they can isolate. You know, the isolation period has been fluid. Currently, it's at 10 days. On the 11th day, they have to take a myocarditis test. And after that, once they pass the myocarditis test, they're cleared to come back to practice. We had about a week there where we only had five or six kids in practice, and we had as many as eight or nine that were either in quarantine or in isolation. And that was right after December 5th. So from December 5th to December 20th, we didn't do a whole lot. We were shut down, I think, for a week. And then after that, it was who's available, what can we do? Because these are unprecedented. You know, we've never been through this. So you just have to navigate it and use your best judgment and common sense. Our strength and conditioning coach is also a nutritionist, and he plans our meals for our kids. But we were delivering three meals a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and also a snack in the evening for our kids that were isolated. And we talked to our staff about it, and I said, I don't want any texting. I want calls. We couldn't go see them, but we could hear. I wanted them to hear our voice, and I wanted to hear their voice. Because you worry about the mental part of it, the emotional part of it, psychological part. When these kids are isolated by themselves during this time of year, it's tough for them. And when they come back after the 10th or 11th day, it usually takes them three or four days to get back to normal. And we've had to go through that, but it's something we're prepared for. The rule now is there's 100. If you test positive, you don't have to get tested again for 150 days. But if you get tested positive in the summer or fall, that window will pass because they were in a 90-day window at the time, and now we have some kids that are back being retested. So we play at South Florida on Thursday, so We came in and got tested Monday, yesterday, and we'll get tested again tomorrow before we leave.
Talking to Houston basketball coach Kelvin Sampson. I mean, Kelvin, there's so much in that response that just blows my mind. I mean, this is so much bigger than basketball, of course. But just so we're very clear about this, every single one of your guys tested positive at one point. And while this is much bigger than basketball, from a basketball standpoint, you are 10-1. You are ranked number 11 in both polls. Ron Hunter, the head coach of Tulane, who you played, a guy that I respect a great deal, said, I don't want to put any pressure on Kelvin, but that's a Final Four team, perhaps, that he has there. Given everything that you just laid out and what this team has gone through, how in the world is this group in the position it's in right now, and what's it say about them that they are?
Well, I don't want to have us put on a pedestal or we're some kind of martyr or something. Everybody's going through this. We're not the only one. You know, every time you look, there's another team on pause. I think there's 16 or 15 teams right now that's going through it. Everybody's going to go through it at some point. We have 13 kids on scholarship and two walk-ons. And each one of those kids at some point since the summer has tested positive. But you just get through it the best you can. You know, we've got good kids. They're high-character kids. Extremely, extremely coachable. And we've just kind of plowed through it. And we've had some tough games. The game we lost was a game we lost at the buzzer. Our kid made two free throws, I think, with 0.1 second to go to beat us. And then we've had some games where we just had to grind it out. But we have a good team. I'm not sure I would repeat what Ron Hunter said about the Final Four team. I've seen two Final Four teams, Baylor and Gonzaga. Then after that, I think you have a lot of teams that are going to be competitive with each other. But this is a year where a lot of teams can make it. But I think the COVID thing is going to dictate what you do and how you do it. The worst thing I think can happen for a team is for the COVID hit in February or early March. That may knock you out. But if it happens early enough in the season, at least you have time to recover from it, and that's what we're doing.
Kelvin Sampson, my guest. Kelvin, one last thought. There's a story that during the offseason, one of the assistants, in fact, your son Kellen, wrote 83-20 on a whiteboard during a Zoom call, and that's the team's record over the past 3 years. What's it say about how far the program has come that we're talking about, even if, you know, you're diminishing some of that talk about the Final Four, but put that aside for a minute. We're talking about a program that's won 80% of their games. Like, were these the goals when you first arrived, or maybe are you even exceeding that?
My goal when I first arrived was to get facilities up to date. We had no practice facility. We were playing in a dilapidated old arena. When we brought a kid on campus, the only place we could take him was my office and show him pictures of what we might build one day. But as I understood it, those pictures were kind of cardboard pictures of a facility that the two coaches prior to me were also using. So, you know, being a bloodhound on the administration, not letting up, making sure that our goals were coordinated, that they wanted this, they wanted to win. And our president, Renu Couture, Tillman Petita, who was the chairman of our board of trustees at the time, those and our athletic directors. I'm on my third athletic director now, but just being bold. You know, one of the things that people have a hard time doing is asking for something that you want, and I've never had a problem doing that. But I give a lot of credit to our administration. They provided us with facilities that allows us to go out and recruit these young men that we can win with, that we can build a program with. But our goal was never have a good team. I think our first year we were 13-19, and since then we've been, you know, successful. But you just keep growing and keep building and evolving and never stop pushing. And I listened to Nick Saban's interview last night after the national championship, and there's so many lessons in there for young coaches about his process and how you want to go about it, and always evolving and never letting up. When I talk to my athletic director, our conversations are, how can we get better? You know, because when you have a mountain in front of you, Jim, you're always climbing the mountain. You never really get on top of it. You're always climbing it. And we're still climbing the mountain and fighting to get better. And that's kind of what our mantra is around here.
I love that. I'm moved by that. I'm inspired by that, especially guys like you, Nick Saban, guys who've been in this game as long as you have, that are still grinding that hard, pushing that hard, still inspired, still motivated. I can't get enough of that. Kelvin Sampson is the head basketball coach at the University of Houston. They are 10-1. They're 11th in both polls, and they are at USF on Thursday. Kelvin, so good to get caught up. I appreciate you coming back on the program. I appreciate the relationship, and it's always good to talk to you, Kelvin.
Same here, Jim. Always good to talk to you, brother. Take care of yourself and your family.
You too, Kelvin. Thanks so much. Andrew Jones is my guest. Andrew, it is so good to have you on the show, Andrew. How are you?
I'm doing well. So glad to be on the show today. Thank you for having me.
It's really good to talk to you. Really nice to have you on the show. You know, there's so much I want to talk to you about, but why don't we start with Saturday in Morgantown, West Virginia. You're down one. West Virginia had a chance to make it a three-point lead, but they missed a couple of free throws with 11 seconds left. You guys get the rebound. You're going down court. What was going through your head in the moments before that final shot?
You know, space the floor. We were fortunate that the guy missed the free throw. You know, Courtney had a great head of steam, getting downhill, and West Virginia just overcommitted. So I was wide open, comfortable, and I knew that I had a lot of time to get the shot off, and I didn't think. I just shot it, and it went in. Felt good when it left my hand.
I was going to say, so Courtney is Courtney Ramey. He drives the lane. The defense collapses around him. He passes to you on outside the three-point line. So you talked about what you were feeling before that shot. How did it feel when you let it go, and then how did it feel with 1.8 seconds left to knock in that shot?
You know, West Virginia played great defense on me the second half. They weren't giving me any open looks, and I was fortunate to have, you know, one of my most open looks throughout the entire game. So I just was ready to shoot the ball. Coach Smart really emphasizing us being ready to shoot and ready to score when the ball comes. And Courtney made a great pass to me, and, you know, it felt great right when I seen that, you know, I had a lot of space, and the shot went in. It felt amazing.
Andrew Jones is joining us. Listen, I think that there are a lot of people listening that are familiar with your story, but not everybody is. The fact that you were diagnosed with leukemia 3 years ago, Saturday was in fact the three-year anniversary of Shaka Smart telling the rest of the team about the diagnosis. What kind of emotions did you feel after the game and after having that moment on the anniversary?
You know, it was a surreal moment for me. You know, just how everything lined up like a domino. You know, it felt great. You know, I'm truly blessed to be here. I'm grateful to just to have the opportunity to be alive and play the sport that I love. So, you know, everything was great. Emotions were high. And, you know, I was just very appreciative of the moment.
Andrew Jones is my guest. You know, I want to be really careful and respectful when talking about this because it's not easy. And I also want to say, Andrew, that I kind of have a sense, like I haven't gone through it personally, but my father had leukemia. So as a family, mm-hmm. we dealt with this. So from that standpoint, I do understand. Shaka made the point that when the news first came, he and everybody else wanted you just to be healthy, just wanted you to be healthy. But you made the point that you were going to come back and you were going to play. Shaka said, mm-hmm. quote, "I don't know a lot of guys that would be able to do what he did from the standpoint of scraping and clawing his way back." I'm curious, what was it like for you to receive the diagnosis and then being so clear that you want to not only remain healthy or get healthy, but you want to come back and you want to play?
You know, it was scary the moment that I found out that I had leukemia. It was shocking. My parents and my family didn't understand where it came from, but we knew the situation could be bad and that we needed to get the best health care possible. And Texas was able to, you know, be able to give me that resource. And talking to my doctors at MD Anderson, Dr. Jabbour, he reassured me that, you know, he was going to be able to help me fight this battle. And then I was going to be able to play basketball again. So the confidence that I was able, that I wanted to be able to come back and play came from my doctor. You know, he assured me that we're going to do the best we can to get me back playing basketball within the next 1 or 2 years. And I trusted him. And I took that same faith, same belief, you know, prayed and trusted God in the work that I wanted to, you know, come back playing basketball better than ever. So it was just my mindset. I really wanted it, you know.
Andrew Jones, my guest, mindset to me is everything. Like, I could spend hours talking to you about this, and we don't have that kind of time, but I'm really curious about the mindset, Andrew, because I think there are people listening that are either dealing with something similar to this, or they know somebody dealing with something like this, or maybe there are people listening that are going through something, because we all are, that's nothing like this. How in the world, and you get bad news, and then sometimes you never get over it, you never shake it, you never begin the process of attacking this. How were you able to get leverage and develop a mindset where you would attack something like this and go after it the way you did?
I think I just chose to listen to my oncologist and to those who were experienced and who are experts in the field of my oncology. I really paid attention to what they were telling me. You know, I just took the mindset of just growth, you know, having a growth mindset to the fact that in order for me to get better, I can't just sit here and just, you know, dwell on my situation. Yes, my situation is bad, and, you know, it's hard to even deal with it. But I try to remain positive, you know, try to enjoy each moment, and I want to just get 1% better each day. I know I was not going to be able to get back 100% in one day, 2 days, or in a week. I knew that steady growth, steady improvement each and every day would amount to, you know, a great success. So I was fortunate that, you know, I had a lot of people around me, family, resources to help me. You know, I would not have been able to do it alone. However, you know, without their help, I don't know where I would be. So I just, you know, try to remain positive, enjoy each day, each moment as if it was my last, and try to get a little better each day that I can.
Wow, what a powerful message. And what's amazing is not only have you fought and made it back to where you are, and I know you would say with the help of a lot of people, but you didn't stop there. You unveiled a logo for the AJ1 Foundation, and part of that is about running a nonprofit AAU team. Like, you're still in college, you're still playing, and you've got a nonprofit AAU team. Where did the idea come from, and why is that so important to you?
The idea came from when I was younger. My father used to work at a Boys and Girls Club, and I was around, you know, a lot of kids growing up, and, you know, it was like an outlet for children after school to come get their work done, play basketball, you know, a safe environment outside of, you know, being alone or running the streets. So I want to be able to provide those who are at disadvantage an opportunity to resources to improve at their basketball skills if they want to, you know, pursue basketball or any sports physical training. I also plan on having tutors and mentors in order to help them with their academics as well, because that's more important than anything if you want to succeed in basketball at this point. So I just want to be able to, you know, give those a chance who may have, you know, disadvantages at home or certain circumstances that might not be available to them. I want to be able to provide a resource, a positive resource, for those who may not have access to it on their own.
So really quickly, it's amazing to me, but like, I could see where somebody like you might say, this is something I might want to get to when I'm older. This is something I might want to do when I'm done playing. Why was it so critical to do it right now?
I feel like it was the time for me to do it now. I feel like there's a need for this in my community, and also that what I've gone through, I've had personal experience with, you know, certain children that I grew up with who didn't have, you know, both parents at home or didn't have, you know, the resources that I was fortunate to get. And going through what I went through, I want to be able to give back as much as I can to those who may not be able to, you know, do it on their own, because I know without the resources I was fortunate to have, I wouldn't be here on my own.
My man, you are very different. You are rare. I'm not sure. I know for a fact, I don't think that I could ever do what you've done. I think a lot of people listening right now would say the same thing. I mean, I can't say how much I respect and appreciate you in this conversation. Andrew, so good to have you on the show. I wish we had more time, but I'm so glad that you were able to share your story and share that message. I can't imagine how many people that helped.
I appreciate you. I'm glad to just be able to share my testimony with those who are in need, and I'm glad to be able to just be able to, you know, come onto your show and share my story.
In market. On topic, Rusty. Hey, Rusty, how are you?
Jim Rome, I apologize for how I sound. My voice is just coming back, what with all the yelling and cheering and whatnot. Honestly, I can't tell you how much your support means to Cleveland. You know, things have been tough around here, what with the unemployment, dropout rate, firebombed houses and the pollution. But none of that matters now because we won a playoff game. I went downtown today, and I didn't even step on a needle. I feel like the luckiest man alive, Jim Rome. I had my doubts after I lost my $600 stimulus check on scratch-off tickets. I got to go. That's my parole officer at the door. War of the Browns and War Lake Erie. I'm out.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
I've got a theory.
Not a very good call.
Homeboy ain't from Cleveland. Backed by 24/7 support, free access to product specialists, and experienced staff at over 250 local branches. So what you want to do is call, click Grainger.com, or just stop on by. All right, so let's get into this Eagles situation. Remember when, about a week ago, Doug Peterson decided to get Nate Sudd some charity reps in that one-score game against a divisional rival? Remember how his explanations after the fact made no sense whatsoever? But then again, they didn't really have to because he already knew that he was safe. I mean, what could they really do to this guy? He won Philadelphia their first Super Bowl ever. He did so only 3 years earlier. I mean, sure, there were some issues. In fact, there were a lot of issues. But Peterson had certainly banked enough goodwill to get the opportunity to fix the issues himself. So he was good, right? Turns out he had not banked enough goodwill. Turns out that ring and all those horse crap sandos that the fans were slamming as a tribute to old Dougie didn't mean a damn thing. Or at least not enough to save his gig. Because Doug got himself fired yesterday. You want to talk about a Philly special. The guy who was the king of misdirection just got misdirected right out of a job. One of the most unbelievable career turns ever. Again, the guy won a Super Bowl in February 2018 and is out on the streets in January of 2021. I mean, again, I know every single coach ever is hired to be fired, but this guy won a Super Bowl in his second season with a backup quarterback on one of the brassest play calls in NFL history. And he's packing up a cardboard box right now. That's amazing. He won the first Super Bowl in franchise history. There's a statue of this guy in Philly. And now his name is getting taken off a parking spot at the facility. He went from having fans eating horse crap to getting kicked to the curb. I mean, do you remember Jason Kelce in that mummer's gear hyping Doug Peterson at the parade? I know I do.
When Doug Peterson was hired, he was rated as the worst coaching hire by a lot of freaking analysts out there in the media. This past offseason, some clown named Mike Lombardi told him that he was the least qualified head coach in the NFL. You saw a driven Doug Peterson, a man who went for it on fourth and down. Went for it on fourth and down in the Super Bowl with the trick play. He wasn't playing. Just to go mediocre. He's playing for a Super Bowl.
I mean, that was an incredible moment. That was an incredible moment. It really was. I'm talking about Kelce and the rant. I mean, the play call was a great moment too. But I mean, that Doug Peterson was the king of the freaking world. And now he's on the unemployment line. 3 years later. And save yourself the time. I already know the email before I get it. Hey, Rome, Doug Peterson got fired a couple of years after winning a Super Bowl. Even I can't believe that fall. Signed, Baby Jessica. Like I said, I know what you're thinking before you think it. Hey, big head, don't text me anything on Baby Jess. Kelly's in. Quote, God, that Kelce sound is so good. Yeah, I know. That's why I played it again, James. Hey, James, I got an idea. What do you say you physically come in this studio and talk to me face-to-face instead of texting me during the show? That way you wouldn't be like a full 30 minutes behind on the stream. Anyway, the thing about Peterson, I mean, it's only been 3 years. And it's not even like they won the Super Bowl and then went right into the tank. It's not like they won that and then he has sucked since that went down. Nothing of the sort. Like, he led the Eagles to the playoffs in 18 and 19. But that's how bad this year was. The guy can win a Super Bowl, go back to the postseason in 2018 and 2019, and then get fired the year after. But that's how bad this was. The 4-11-1 record, the Nate Sudd disaster, the complete and total dysfunction throughout the season, the lack of answers for anything that was going on, everything that happened with Carson Wentz, and now this. Team owner Jeffrey Lurie said, or was asked, exactly what went into a decision like that.
My first allegiance is what will be best for the Philadelphia Eagles and our fans for the next 3, 4, 5 years. It's not based on does someone deserve to hold their job or deserve to get fired. That's a different bar. It's not about did Doug deserve to be let go. No, he did not deserve to be let go. That's not where I'm coming from, and that's not the bar in the evaluation process.
Speaking of that bar, and Peterson's probably still at that bar. According to Lurie, he didn't deserve to be let go, but he got let go. That's a hell of an explanation. He didn't deserve to be fired, but I went ahead and fired him anyway. Except I see Lurie working. Because on paper, a guy who wins the first Super Bowl never gets fired 3 years later. But Peterson did. And there are a lot of reasons for that, I'm sure. So many, I'm not even sure where to start. Like that Nate Sudd fiasco and the collapse of Carson Wentz. And then the internal struggle in the organization about Peterson's staff. These are all things that have been reported. It seems like that last thing, too, is a big deal. The internal struggle about his staff. Like, if you believe the reports, Peterson wanted final say on his coaching staff, and Lurie and GM Howie Roseman had thoughts of their own. Like, I get where the coach doesn't want to be told who to hire and how to assemble a staff. And if you're winning, then that's the way that's going to be, right? No one's going to tell you what to do if you're winning. But if you're getting your ass kicked, and all those staffers are not on the same page, and there doesn't seem to be that one unifying vision that everybody gets and buys into, then of course your boss is going to say what may have worked for you in the past is not working right now, and that the guys you hired are not getting it done, because they're not. And by the way, that's a big part of this, right? Peterson lost some really important guys off that staff that helped him win that Super Bowl and then did not do a good job of replacing them. So of course the owner and the GM are going to come to him and say, hey, listen, you got to make some changes on that staff. And then, of course, the head coach is going to say, no, don't tell me what to do. Those are my guys. And there's a certain loyalty. And then, of course, they're going to give him a cardboard box and say, fill it up, hit the bricks. The bigger question is, everything fell off a cliff this year. I mean, it's bigger than just Carson Wentz. It's bigger than just the staff. The bigger question is, like, everything went to hell. So the big question is, Lurie and Roseman had asked themselves, everything is going to hell. Is Peterson the guy to fix it? Can he solve these problems? Can he fix it? I mean, maybe he didn't cause every one of these problems, but somebody's got to fix them. Is he the guy to fix them? And clearly, the owner decided, no, he's not. And I can't say that I blame him either, because everything did turn to crap this year. That epic collapse of Carson Wentz. The guy went from being an MVP candidate to a backup to not dressing at all to wanting out of town altogether because he reportedly could no longer coexist with Peterson. This guy was an MVP candidate like 5 minutes ago. How did all that happen? It got so bad that the guy they invested so much time and money in couldn't even stand to be around the head coach and couldn't play for him and wanted out. So they were going to have to trade Wentz and have the biggest dead cap hit in league history, and they still would not have had clarity at the quarterback position. Or they could fire the coach. So if you're faced with that decision, what are you going to do? How much of that collapse in Wentz was on Peterson? How much of that was on Wentz? And while Wentz is clearly broken, can he be fixed? The Eagles obviously think he can. Or they would have kept Peterson and traded Wentz. Instead, they fired Peterson. All right, so I'm not saying that that's what this is about exclusively, but clearly they picked Wentz over Peterson. So finally, and I can go on for about an hour on this, but the questions are then, who do you bring in to fix Wentz and the Eagles? And then how much damage has Peterson done to his rep? And how attractive a candidate is he for somebody else? Like, I'm going to argue that despite that Super Bowl win, that Eagle job is not as good as the Eagles think it is. And Peterson, in terms of being a hireable candidate, despite winning the Super Bowl, is not as hireable nor as good of a coach as everybody thought he was. How the hell could he be when he completely lost a locker room and his job only 3 years after winning it all?
The least qualified head coach in the NFL.
Good night.